Most famous. Oops. Thank you. Sorry. One of the most famous parshas in the Torah is Parshas Zachar. So we'll talk a little bit about Parshas Zachar and some of the Rashis in Parshas Zachar. Thank you. But the first Rashi speaks not about the parsha, but about the juxtaposition to the previous section. Parshas Zachar is located in Parshas Ki Tetzeh. And the previous section speaks about morality, in specific in the area of business details and business interactions. The parsha right before Parsha Zachar mentions proper business ethics and proper business conduct, scales, weights, measurements, business integrity, business ethics. So Rashi comments, Im shakarta b'midos, if you lie about your scales and your business ethics, of mishkalos, have a doeg migiri ha'oyev. You should worry about the enemy entering. Because of this juxtaposition, Rashi quotes two psukim from Mishle that highlight the dangers that the Jewish people will face if they're not ethical and honest in their business dealings. Now, of course, this Rashi could be understood as HaKadosh Baruch Hu's punishment for us. HaKadosh Baruch Hu employs Amalek as his whip or as his tool to warn us or to punish us for improper business ethics. But it could also be understood in a more naturalist way, that when the Jewish people aren't careful about their ethics and their morality, then they're inviting an enemy, and not just any enemy, but they're inviting Amalek. And let's speak about how, from a natural causal factor, improper business behavior can invite and create vulnerabilities for enemies in general and for Amalek in particular. On the one hand, as we've seen in the modern era, social trust and social harmony is a national asset. United countries are more patriotic, they're more selfless, they're willing to stick their necks out for one another. So societies that are fraught with dysfunction and social fissure and social strife are weaker societies. We've seen, unfortunately, over the last 5 or 10 years, in some cases it's fortunate, because many of these countries were enemies of the Jewish people. But at a human level, it's unfortunate to see the phenomena called failed states, where states just collapse in on themselves, whether it's Iraq or Syria or Libya, now unfortunately in Venezuela. In many of these cases, it's because the social fabric wasn't healthy. And there were too many clans and too many different religions and too many different ethos and cultures. To a degree, that's what failed the Soviet Empire. The Soviet Empire had too many different cultures that were represented, and they couldn't create one unifying social fabric. So trust and the ability to trust one another and the ability to have a society function on trust is a national asset that's just as important as another tank or another missile. Today, unfortunately, the government of Israel and the, not just Bibi Netanyahu, but the overall government has been plagued by an alleged corruption scandal. And whoever is guilty will have to, of course, be indicted and discovered. But there are all types of conversations, assuming people believe that the current government may be more effective politically, but if they're morally unsound, should they still be allowed to direct the country? That's obviously a political conversation, but the conversation has to be conducted not morality versus geopolitical stability or security. Morality is security. If this country delves or descends into a state where bribes and corruption block the proper flow and execution of government, then the social fabric will fray, and that will be itself a military and security vulnerability. So the ability to create a society of trust and unity is absolutely crucial. And when that starts to falter because of improper business methods, then of course we expose vulnerabilities to enemies in general. The second issue, and also to borrow from the modern state of Israel, is the pasuk in the Torah is not just describing ethics in general, but ethics in the workplace, the ability to create not just a corruption-free society of trust, but one that can function properly business and can produce prosperity, welfare, wealth, advance. The state of Israel is surrounded by hostile enemies on all fronts, possibly with more natural resources than the state of Israel possesses. Part of the equalizer is, of course, HaKadosh Baruch Hu's help and assistance. Part of the equalizer is the human element, human resources in Eretz Israel. part of the equalizer is that Israel has become an economic superpower over the last 30 years. Those of us who remember Israel in the 80s was an economic weakling. Now it's an economic superpower. And economics are inherently connected to military, security, the strength of a society. So it's not just the morality and the social trust that's affected through improper business dealings. It's also creating an economically stable, vibrant, powerful society that's able not just to purchase weapons and weaponry and defense, but to create a robust and sound society. Economic strength is a military asset, even if it never gets translated into military purchases or military. You build relationships, you gain more influence, you interact with other countries through trade, and that creates alliances. For example, Israel just sold $15 billion of gas to Egypt. Now, that seems like a financial transaction, but it's really a diplomatic and military transaction because we're strengthening our relationship with Egypt. Egypt is far less interested in warring with Israel, either overtly or covertly, because they need our gas and they need our economic, or water can also be used in the modern context to provide diplomacy and alliances. So if you don't have a properly functioning society, not just because you've created distrust and bribery and corruption, because you can't do proper business, society will also collapse in on itself, and you can't prevent or protect yourself against an enemy. But then there's a third reason that these two parshios are juxtaposed, because improper moral behavior is not just creating a socially frayed fabric that invites or allows foreign enemies to invade. It's specifically Amalek. Amalek isn't just some random country that attacks the Jewish people based on whim, caprice, or historical opportunity. Amalek is Esav's grandson. Literally, Eliphaz was Esav's son, Amalek was Eliphaz's son. And Amalek was always tasked with challenging the selection of Yaakov over Esav. He still bristles that Yaakov, in his mind, snatched the Bechorah from Esav. Esav should have been the chosen flock, not Yaakov. And therefore, Amalek always rears its head at particularly vulnerable historical junctions. So, for example, when the Jews are leaving Egypt, they're about to enter Israel. The original plan had us entering Israel in 10 days or a couple months. So Amalek has to halt that, because if the Jews make it to Israel, that will be another consolidation of Yaakov's status at Esav's expense. The next moment that Amalek rears its head is when the Jewish people finally achieve monarchy. The Jews have appointed their first king, Shaul. If the Jews achieve monarchy in Israel, that will once again consolidate Jewish identity in this world and Jewish selection. So Agag has to war with Shaul. And Haman appears on the scene because the Beis HaMikdash has already started to be built. The second Beis HaMikdash was already constructed, the infrastructure. It was halted. And Haman knows that if he allows the Beis HaMikdash to unfold, then once again Yaakov will achieve selection. So the war between the Jewish people and Amalek is not a military war. It's a historical and theological war about who will represent HaKadosh Baruch Hu in our world. It's played out on the military battlefield. But we assert that we were chosen, we represent Hashem, we are the Am HaNivchar, and Amalek is constantly trying to undercut and subvert that. Well, we represent Hashem in this world on two fronts. Theologically, we want to suggest that there's one God in this world, a bold assertion that humanity couldn't grasp on its own, and we introduced to the modern vernacular, because the world seems divided. There's so many different forces and beings and light and dark and strong. How could there be one God? We've convinced the entire world that there is one God. But in addition, we don't just stand for Hashem theologically. We represent Hashem morally, that he's the Melech Ohet Tzedakah Mishpat, that Hashem is not angry. He doesn't punish man randomly. And Hashem doesn't desire suffering. And he wants a world of prosperity. And he wants a world of kindness. He wants a world of compassion, because he's Sim Shalom Tova Vracha, he's Avarachaman. Man couldn't get that point either, because all he had seen from God was destruction, calamity, floods, population dispersal. So our message in this world is to represent Hashem morally, not just theologically. When we fail to broadcast that message, Amalek's challenge to our position becomes even more acute and more successful. As Amalek's claiming, maybe you shouldn't be the Am HaNivchar. When we don't act like the Am HaNivchar, and we no longer represent Hashem, that lends even more credibility and more compulsion to their claim. You're no longer fulfilling your role. That was part of Haman's challenge as well. Haman challenged right after the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash, 70 years afterwards. You were the Haman Yifchar, but you've compromised that status, and you're no longer in Eretz Yisrael. And Hashem burnt your Beis HaMikdash. So the fact that we're unable to broadcast our moral message isn't just practically an invitation for an enemy. It lends greater strength to Amalek's challenge to our role in history when we don't act based on a historical warrant to represent HaKadosh Baruch Hu in this world. I'll just end with one more Rashi. Rashi describes the word Asher Karcha Baderach. So Rashi gives three interpretations. One interpretation is they met you randomly, Milashon Keri. One interpretation is social irregularity, Milashon Keri. They abused him sexually. The third interpretation of Rashi is that you are a hot bathtub and Amalek cooled you down. They cooled you down from your heat. Everyone was afraid of you. And they demonstrated to the world, kamikaze-like, that the Jewish people could be messed with and toyed with and warred with. And that invited others to challenge the Jewish people, militarily at least. And Rashi employs the metaphor of a hot bathtub that's so boiling hot that no one can touch it. And a person comes and flings himself into the bathtub, and it becomes a little cooler. And other people are now better able or easier able to access that bathtub or that hot body of water. And Rashi says the person who jumps in gets burnt. It's a very strange metaphor. The Jewish people like a bathtub, like a bath of hot water. We rarely find this metaphor. More likely you'd expect there to be fire, you'd expect there to be... What does it mean the Jewish people like a bathtub? So the answer is part of this metaphor is not really to associate Jewish people with the bathwater, but to associate some of our enemies with the person who jumps in. That person who jumps in is essentially shooting himself in the leg. Is essentially so interested in cooling the bathtub that he's willing to burn himself, fourth-degree burns, in order to cool down the bathtub. He's going to suffer. Rashi says the person who jumps in is going to get badly burnt. Sometimes in history, and this is the ethos of Amalek, Amalek isn't just a people, it's also a concept that recurs in history. The hatred of Jews is so severe, is so toxic, it's so psychopathic that our haters are willing to act in ways that are suicidal and counterproductive, just to destroy Jews. They're willing to jump into a bathtub, burn themselves, inflict wounds on themselves and their interests, just to burn the Jews and just to cool the Jews down. So, for example, Hitler. Hitler was struggling in the latter part of 44, in the early part of 45, to protect and to defend his Third Reich on two fronts. He was battling huge armies on the Eastern Front, united armies on the Western Front. And how many resources does he continue to divert to exterminating Jews in Central Europe? How many soldiers does he divert to the trains, to the concentration camps, to the Gestapo? Who knows, if not for that psychopathic hatred of the Jews, whether Hitler may have won the war at some point? How many resources does he divert? He hates Jews so much that he's willing to be suicidal and to defeat his own larger agenda, because hatred of Jews is something so deep because of our role of as Am HaNivchar. Paro keeps pushing the envelope and pushing his agenda, even when he knows it's his own firstborn that's on the crosshairs. Russia comes and says, Hashem's going to interdict, and it's going to murder your firstborn. You think at that point self-interest would dictate at least to stand down and let Moshe leave. Sometimes the hatred, we see this sadly enough, in our own era. People willing to die, suicide bombers, willing to ruin their own. I mean, what would the state of the population, and this is in no way meant to be an insensitive statement, but what would the state of the population in Gaza be like if all the monies that had been donated internationally would have been directed for humanitarian issues, for health clinics, food, infrastructure, school, education, and yet again and again, concrete, steel, bunkers and tunnels and arms and missiles. Such is the hatred of a Jew, and that hatred was on full display when Amalek suicidally flung themselves in front of the steamroller Asher Karcha Baderach. All they wanted to do was to halt the Jewish people, even at the cost of their own national agenda and their own well-being. So two Rashis. One Rashi about the juxtaposition of business ethics and proper morality and the war with Amalek. Number two, Asher Karcha Baderach, the third shot, we were hot, too hot to handle, as we would say. And they jumped in, even at their own personal injury, in order to cool us down. Shabbat Shalom, everyone. Sorry, I'm losing my voice, my health, pretty much everything.
And you have a singing Shabbos.
Shabbos.
You have a sing, right? You have a singing Shabbos.
No, I'm not.
Are you having Shia early or regular today?
Regular, but I think I'm going to have to end early. I'm not sure.
I have a busy day, but actually.